From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH, live, local talk, Boston Public Radio.
I'm Emily Rooney, and this is Boston Public Radio. It's our Week in Review, and as you just heard Christina Quinn say, apparently Congressman Ed Markey has some competition. Congressman Stephen Lynch announced just a short time ago that he is in for the race for the Senate, so there will be a Democratic primary after all, something that Governor Deval Patrick had hoped for. Anyway, it's been a big week in politics. It kicked off the president's inauguration on Monday. He had a lofty list of goals from climate change to gay rights, but it's been overshadowed by Beyonce's lip-syncing. Or was it? I don't know. We'll get that to it and get to that in our thumbs up, thumbs down. Joining me here today for the Week in Review are State Senator Robert Hedlund, Peniel Joseph, Professor of History and Founding Director of the Center for the Study of Race and Democracy at Tufts University, and attorney and social critic Wendy Kaminer. Starting with you, Bob, what do you make of the fact that Steve Lynch got in? He's been kind of hinting that he would, and he said he didn't care what endorsements Congressman Markey has. That's not going to that's not going to be the determining factor for him.
I think he brings some strong suits to the campaign, and I think he'll be a worthy opponent for Ed Markey. I wouldn't be surprised if he wins the primary. And, you know, I talked to some people this week that are very close to him who told me he was going to announce on Monday, so I'm very disappointed that I didn't have a scoop for the show today.
I wonder why he didn't. He's been talking about it all week. He might have just not wanted
to do it. Yeah, I'm not a PR expert, but I thought
Inauguration Day might have been a bit a weak day to come out and
I'm not a PR and media expert, but I thought you saved bad news for Fridays and good news for Mondays. But
I
don't think it's a surprise that he's in, and he'll be formidable in the primary. And he'll be, I think, potentially a much better nominee for the Democrats against, say, a Scott Brown.
I think Ed Markey is going to blow him out of the water.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. I think Scott Brown's having a very good day today. I don't think he has a significant chance of beating Ed Markey in the primary. He does have a significant chance of damaging Ed Markey in the primary. Mm-hmm. He better stay out of Chuck Schumer's way is really all I have to say about this. I don't know how much money Steve Lynch has. I don't know how much money Markey
has
to
spend.
Markey has $3.1 million. Yeah. At least that's what he had when he started it. I don't know how much money they will have to spend on this, but you know it's a win-win for Steve Lynch because he doesn't have to give up his seat in order to
Neither does Ed Markey,
and if Markey prevails, if Markey loses to Scott Brown or whoever else the Republicans put up, if Brown decides not to run, Steve Lynch may have better prepared himself for a run in the Senate election 2 years from now, because remember, we have a special election in June or July, and then we have another election in 2014.
So, but Peniel, this can get really ugly. Whenever you have two people from the same party, essentially in the same job, the part of the delegation, it's not like one person is a state senator or a Democratic state representative, anything like that. It's the same job. So you're going to have to call on each other's record in Congress, and that's what they're going to be doing.
Yeah, but I think it's going to be short. I mean, I think Markey has the backing of the Democratic establishment. I think this is going to be very, very short. I think for Democrats, there's a worry that people were so excited to elect Elizabeth Warren that how many people are going to come out for a special election. So Scott Brown, whether he's facing Markey or Lynch, Markey most likely, he's sitting pretty.
I don't know.
I've heard, and Bob, you might know more about this than I do, but I've heard that Carrie Healey is considering getting into the Republican Senate race. In terms
really?
Of turnout,
that would be interesting.
That would be a lot of fun. In terms of turnout, obviously it's not a presidential election year, and that's a big problem. Yeah. But I think the Democrat, whether it's Markey or surprises us, and as Steve Lynch, is going to have strong Democratic labor support. I think they're going to make the kind of effort in this race that they made for Elizabeth Warren, which was very successful.
Yeah, they learned their lesson in the Brown race,
that's
for sure.
Right.
It's interesting. I didn't hear the Carrie Healey rumor, but you're picking up intel regarding Republican primaries, I guess, and I'm picking up intel on Democrat primaries, so this is confusing. But I'm surprised to hear your take on the Markey race, that it's a foregone conclusion for Markey. I don't think it will be an easy road for Ed Markey in this race?
I don't think it'll be easy. I don't think it's a foregone conclusion, but I think that he is the favorite in a Democratic
he's
primary.
He's also he's glib in a way. He's had some very, very important positions, congressional jobs. I think he just has a stature and a status that Representative Lynch just – I mean, good guy. I mean, I like him too, but he just – he's not quite there. And this whole thing about labor and, I'm an iron worker. Who cares? Nobody cares.
Nobody knows who Ed Markey is. The guy
Nobody
hasn't
knows
been,
who
a,
Steve
hasn't been
is.
Around.
You know, Ed Markey is as well known as Steve Lynch. You know, that's probably a wash for both of them.
But one thing we have to say is that there's going to be exceptionally low turnout in the Democratic primary, and there's going to be low turnout in the special election, especially coming on the heels of November's presidential election. So when the Democratic machine is behind you, you're going to get those votes. So it's going to be very hard for Lynch to bring those people to the polls. But when we get to the special election, June, July, I think it's going to be very hard for Democrats in this sense, that when we think about the Coakley, Martha Coakley, Scott Brown election in when was that, January of 2010, Martha Coakley loses by over 100,000 votes. There were independents and right-leaning Democrats who were very excited about Scott Brown. This is going to be his third election in 3 years if he runs. It's going to be very difficult for Democrats to really galvanize the base. Maybe labor, like Wendy's saying, is going to galvanize the base.
Remember, the 100th, I think there were, a million? There was a small number of votes in the Coakley-Brown race. Brown won by about 100,000 votes.
Yeah, there's about
and
2 million
I think that votes. That what... What won it for him were union households.
Mm-hmm. I think it was turncoats. I agree with Pinero.
No, but
turncoats.
I think the data showed that it
women.
Was that union households made a big difference.
Mm-hmm. And evidence of that. I come from Weymouth, the highest per capita household union community in Massachusetts. And Brown had his largest plurality in the town of Weymouth.
Right,
and the exit polling suggests that union households broke for Brown significantly.
Right. Mm-hmm. And when Brown was a state senator, he had support from union households that he no longer had after he had served 2 years in the U.S. Senate. And the Democrat had the support of labor in this state that Coakley had not had. It's going to make a very big difference.
But, Steve Lynch and Ed Markey will have unions.
Yeah, but Elizabeth Warren was a rock star. Ed Markey is not going to be a rock star. People don't understand the way in which Elizabeth Warren got thousands of volunteers to come out for her in this past election. It's going to be very hard for the machine to reproduce that.
I understand that. I'm simply saying that the turnout's going to be lower for Scott Brown, too. It's going to be lower for everybody. What made the difference for Scott Brown in 2010 were union households, mm-hmm. and I don't think he's going to have that edge this time
around. Let me just offer one final thought on this, if I may, regarding the union households and low turnout. That's going to be obviously the key. Is who's going to get those union households. So the interesting part of this primary race on the Democrat side will be what will the union labor, what will AFL-CIO, what will locals, your county labor councils, where are they going to break? Are they going to reward Steve Lynch for being one of them with a strong union record, or are they going to break for Ed Markey and reward him for his tenure and length of service and the fact that he seems to be the anointed one in this race. That's going to be the key, I think, with
for the
low turnout.
For the primary. Yeah. But in the general, absolutely. They're going to get out for whoever the Democratic candidate
is. Oh, absolutely, absolutely.
All right, we shall see. It makes it more interesting. And I do think it's kind of amusing that Governor Deval Patrick kind of wished this, because I had Marisa DeFranco here a couple of weeks ago, and she said he wasn't looking for any kind of Democratic primary when I was running. So.
Well, he said he wished it, Emily.
Yeah.
But, I wouldn't necessarily, much as I like the
governor,
I wouldn't necessarily take that at face value.
All right. Also, this week, we heard last week that Lieutenant Governor Tim Murray says he will not run for governor. He didn't cite a whole lot of reasons, but...
He didn't have to.
Right. But, I asked the governor, I had the governor on Greater Boston last night, and I said, well, did he feel dogged by these investigations, by the unanswered questions about the car crash now more than a year ago, unanswered questions about his relationship with the former Chelsea Housing director, Mike McLaughlin. And then, of course, right after we finished taping, the news broke that that there is an investigation, although there are no charges yet, that some fundraising improprieties in the lieutenant governor's campaign and ties to the Chelsea Housing Authority that Michael McLaughlin, as a director, a public employee, if he had a fundraiser on behalf of Lieutenant Governor Tim Murray, that would have been, illegal or, I don't know.
Well, Tim Murray better hope that Carmen Ortiz doesn't decide to throw one of her many books at him.
I guess it would be a federal. I mean, but they haven't.
Emily, almost anything is a federal offense these days.
Yeah, well, you want to talk about that? That's crazy. I know. It's like I love you and your friend Harvey Silverglade on all this stuff with Carmen Ortiz. Talk about overreaching.
It's not just Carmen Ortiz. It's U.S. attorneys in general and this voluminous, elastic federal criminal code that, as Harvey Silverglade says, makes potential felonies of us all.
Yeah.
Just like the federal tax code. Same idea.
Yeah. I mean, we saw it with Martha Coakley, too. By the way, I heard that the Tim Cahill thing was going to be resolved by today. Hasn't happened yet, but that's what I was told by somebody close to the investigation.
Well, we've been on the show before talking about that case as it was pending. And, I mean, you asked us our predictions on it. My prediction was correct, I might add.
Maybe
you can roll the tape.
We believe that
we're not going to find him guilty, so she should work something out. I mean, to bring that to trial again would be ridiculous.
Mm. Mm. My intel says that the jury, it was a hung jury, as you all recall, that the jury was 11-1 to acquit.
Yeah, so I can't imagine she would try to bring this case again. I can't imagine.
Well, you know, she doesn't want to lose it, and there's still some things hanging out there. She wants him to concede something. You know, maybe it's a fine or something. I think they're trying to work something out. I don't think she's just going to let him walk out of here.
And it'll be interesting how she pursues the Murray case, you know, which is the topic we started here.
And what do you make of the Murray case? I mean, is it much ado about nothing?
No, absolutely. I think there's significant
ado.
I think there's I think there is a potential pattern of fundraising irregularities, okay? And I think that the McLaughlin thing was potentially the tip of the iceberg. I've seen bits and pieces of it, you know, in terms of how some of the patronage has worked. It's an element of pay to play with this administration. And I think to a certain degree, the lieutenant governor has been in charge of a lot of that patronage. I wouldn't be surprised if, for instance, the Sheila Burgess situation, that there were ties to him. And the administration.
We should explain who she is. She's the one who she was
the governor's Highway Safety Bureau
who
director.
Who had a record of 30.
It's a plum job.
It's a record of highway unsafety.
Well, no, I think
and to say that, you know, they didn't know how she wound up in that position, that's a plum job.
Yeah, but there's patronage jobs in state houses all across the United States. I think in terms of Mary.
But you don't put someone in charge of highway safety.
I understand that.
In terms of Mary,
when we look at what the Boston Globe, the front page stories that they've done in 2012 about both Mary but also Chelsea Housing Authority, this is also connected to the governor's inability to just streamline the process. Former governor of Pennsylvania, Ed Rendell, had a great story about how he transformed Pennsylvania housing authorities. When he first became governor, there were dozens and dozens. He needed there was a budget shortfall for schools, and he needed money for public schools in Pennsylvania. He called up the head of the housing authority and told him that he was taking 65% of his budget, and there was only going to be one housing authority for the whole state. And he hung up, and that was the end of the multiple
Why don't we do that?
Housing authorities.
What do we need housing authorities for anyway?
Ed Rendell is an old-fashioned governor who really utilizes his power as chief executive of a state, and Governor Patrick has been more reluctant to do that.
Well, the governor put a plan on the table, just kind of threw it out there. There hasn't been any legwork behind it. I think I was the only elected official I saw on the news accounts of that were quoted that didn't reject it out of hand.
Mm-hmm. Reject what?
The governor's proposal to consolidate housing authority bureaucracy in the state.
Why did they reject
six figure directors?
Why was it rejected?
Why do you think? Because look at how housing authorities are used for patronage. Yeah. How they're used to control politicians. Mm-hmm. Used to have consolidate power connections. You know, every Democrat that was quoted in the news accounts of the governor's proposal basically rejected it, some politely, some not so politely.
Sure.
And there's a huge potential for savings there. And I said, it's something we ought to look at and pursue and examine and analyze. So, you know, old ideas die hard on Beacon Hill, especially when you're bucking and bumping heads over anything that has to do with patronage or, you know, the old school old boy network.
That's not an idea. That's a perquisite.
Exactly.
Talking to social critic and attorney Wendy Kaminer, Peniel Joseph from Tufts University, and State Senator Robert Hedlund. So Patrick also had his State of the State last week, put forth his $35 billion budget on new taxes. Well, you know, there's a whole lot of equivocating here because there's some things that, you know, the personal exemptions are going to double, but a lot of these personal tax write-offs are going to go down. Sales tax is going to go down. Income tax is going to go up. But the bottom line is that taxes are going up. You know, he's going to raise $2 billion off of the – it would go into effect January 14th.
Especially for upper income taxpayers.
What do you make of it? And when do you like new taxes? Come on.
You know, I can't say that I'm happy about the prospect of paying new taxes, but I strongly support the governor's effort to make the tax code more progressive. Mm-hmm. And beyond that, I really admire the way he has framed this issue. I saw him on your show mm-hmm. last night, Emily. And, you know, he's put it forward very straightforwardly. He has said, I understand people don't want to pay new taxes, and if they decide they don't want to, they have to understand that there's a trade-off. Mm-hmm. In government, as in the private market, you get what you pay for. And yes, we can cut a certain amount of waste, but, you know, we couldn't cut nearly enough to improve the transportation systems, to rebuild our infrastructures, to provide education, to restore cuts in essential services that people want mm-hmm. restored. So, you know, he's in a way putting it out there. Let the people choose. Let them choose if they want to pay a little more in taxes, especially upper income taxpayers, many of whom really can afford it, or if they want a reduced level of services.
Well, I think it's a little more complicated in terms of how we define upper income, because I think in this plan, if you're making over $102,000, you're going to be paying $3,000 a year more. I think that's fundamentally unfair. And I think that one of the things about Obama and the tax plan that got passed, it was $400,000 or more. Mm-hmm. Because if you're living in the East Coast in a place like Boston and you're a family of four, parents and two kids, and you're sending your kids to maybe private school, you've got a mortgage that's $600,000-$800,000. Patrick, now the governor's asking too much of a family that's making $106,000 mm-hmm. after deductions, $119,000. Upper income, the way I define it in 2013, would be a family of four who, after all their deductions, is making about $400,000. And could they afford that other $3,000 a year? Yes. But mm-hmm. so this is not fair. How the governor is describing upper income.
Well, you know, Peniel, I take your point. It's not fair. You're right about that. And the other thing to add to that is that unlike the federal tax raise, this is not a marginal tax hike.
Yeah.
In other words,
that was more than marginal. Have you gotten a paycheck recently?
No. I don't. Well,
that 2%. Holy.
No, but when I say it's marginal, I mean that, for example, the extra points on income kicks in after you've made a certain amount of money. I don't believe that the Patrick proposal works that way. I think the extra points, the extra 10 points, kick in on all of your money. Okay. So it is proportionately a bigger bite.
Yeah.
Well, just to put this in a little bit of perspective, someone who will have to vote on
this. Yeah, you're going to have to vote on the whole thing, the whole shebang.
There's some in there I like. There's much in there I don't like in the governor's proposal. But the reality is every governor, whether it's Republican or Democrat, their budget's pretty much dead on arrival before it even lands.
Meaning you guys tear it apart.
In our doorstep. Right. Well, tear it apart. It's basically ignored. I mean, and this one is probably going to be ignored more than others. Now, the extremity of these tax hike proposals that the governor's put forward may provide some cover for the legislative leadership to do some incremental tax increases. However, I will tell you right now, there doesn't appear to be any appetite for a gas tax increase amongst my colleagues, number one. Number two, if you read the comments of a lot of the legislative leaders, you can pretty much read between the lines that this is dead. You know, things like the governor likes to throw along, and the House chairman right. of Ways and Means made some comments in the last couple of days that, you know, if you read them, it was pretty clear that he's not taking these proposals seriously. And some of the stuff in here, you really have to look not so much at the revenue proposals the governor's put forward, which are pretty extreme, and Peniel's analysis is accurate. It's what he proposes to spend on that's going to get a lot of scrutiny,
well,
too.
That's the,
and there's
that's
a lot
thing,
of pie
mostly
in the sky stuff in here.
Though.
Yeah, absolutely. Emily, it is a sin. It is a sin. And I serve on the Transportation Committee now for 20 years. It was when I arrived on Beacon Hill, I've been on that committee. And I've watched in great frustration. I've watched as some leaders like Bob Prince, former GM of the MBTA, who wanted to do Green Line modernization. And what happened this week on the Green Line is it's a sin mm-hmm. that we have put forward capital expansion over maintenance in the state continually And to leave those people out in the cold like that for things that shouldn't have happened and should have been addressed 15 years ago, 20 years ago, that some who were responsible in leadership positions wanted to, and Republican and Democrat administrations are culpable here because they had groundbreaking mentalities. And let me just wrap up and say this. This proposal repeats the mistakes of the past. He's going to take sorely needed funds like $2 billion to build a rail line to New Bedford Fall River, which nobody can sit and tell us how you're going to operate it. Forget building it. If we gave you the $2 billion and we raise the income tax and we build it, the level of subsidy for that line would destroy and put the MBTA into bankruptcy for the operating deficit it will create. So nobody addresses that. Nobody's given us answers.
Well, one thing on transportation, very quickly, the positives are, if you read the Globe has talked about how in poorer communities like Dorchester and Roxbury, we have a real transportation problem in Boston,
absolutely,
real inequality about bus lines, especially in minority and poor communities. So part of this money is supposed to go for that. I'm not talking about the New Bedford part. The positives of this budget is that it's forward-looking, in terms of investment and growth. I think that you're more credible with a forward-looking budget if you're really rooting out corruption. So the very fact that you have a budget like this, and we just talked about the Chelsea housing authorities and all these multiple housing authorities, is problematic. So that's if the governor streamline that and was able to do that and then proposes something like this, it becomes much more credible. But when we think about transportation in this city, we should think about transportation and poverty. Poor people are stuck out in the cold, mm-hmm, in places like Mattapan and
right,
Dorchester
and those Roxbury are the people we should be looking to serve in this budget, Peniel, and we're not. And you know, we can hide behind the word investment like politicians love to do. But, you know, I can go invest money with Bernie Madoff. What does it get me in the end? And let me tell you something. Fall River, New Bedford is the Bernie Madoff of transportation capital projects. I think it's a political stunt, quite frankly. I don't think it'll ever be built because nobody can tell us how to pay for the operation of it. Nobody can tell us that. There's some vague thing about, well, if we get a casino down there, we're gonna earmark new tax growth and revenue growth to pay for the subsidy of it. It's pie in the sky.
The budget proposal overall, I think, is not a political stunt, but it is a political document. And I don't imagine that...
No, I said Fall River, New Bedford.
Right, no, I know you did, Bob. I know you did that. I don't imagine that the governor expects that the legislature is going to embrace his budget. You know, he understands the reality of that. But I think what he's doing is, in some ways, staking out a kind of negotiating position, staking out possibilities at maybe one end of a spectrum. Mm-hmm. And also, as I said before, I think the primary thing that he's doing, mm-hmm, is framing the debate. And I think he's framing the debate in a pretty productive way.
Right, right. And that's why I think, you know, it gives them some cover in the legislature to have an incremental increase over.
Right.
Okay, going back into the week, I'm talking here to social critic and attorney Wendy Kaminer, Peniel Joseph, founding director of the Center for the Study of Race and Democracy at Tufts, and State Senator Bob Hedlin. Did any of you get to watch in any length or depth at all the testimony of Hillary Clinton for both the Senate and the House?
Brilliant, brilliant, brilliant.
She was.
Yeah, she was brilliant.
I mean, I don't care what side of the fence you're on. Yeah. It was absolutely brilliant. And yet, all anybody was talking about, and every news media, left, right, middle, center, wings of every, all they could focus on was the two times she got emotional and the one time she barked at Rand Paul. Here's the Rand Paul exchange.
We were misled that there were supposedly protests and then something sprang out of that, an assault sprang out of that. And that was easily ascertained that was not the fact.
But
and the American people could have known that within days, and they didn't know that.
With all due respect, the fact is we had four dead Americans. Was it because of a protest, or was it because of guys out for a walk one night who decided they'd go kill some Americans? What difference at this point does it make?
That was Ron Johnson, actually. Yeah,
yeah,
I thought she was brilliant. What difference does it make?
Well, but I think this was positive 100%, Emily. I'll tell you why. America has never had a modern day Margaret Thatcher, a prime minister, a president. She's heroic. She's an iconic figure. Democrats and Republicans all know it. We're probably looking at a future president of the United States, the first female president in January of 2017.
I actually
am not doubting. No. I actually think that she's going to run definitively, and I think she's going to be the nominee. And I think she's most, you know, very, very likely going to be president. I think the idea that after all this, she's not going to run. If you read the new biography by Bill Chafe on Hillary and Bill, you get a sense of whether she when she was at Wellesley, when she was a little girl, the ambition, Georgetown. I mean,
I know,
it's
I think she's had her day.
Look, you know,
regardless, she was brilliant.
Why do you think she's had her day?
Pinio, we have no idea whether or not she's going to run. We do know that she's going to be.
Well, I think we have some idea, Wendy.
I think Hillary Clinton and her husband and her daughter have some idea of whether or not she's going to run. She's going to be 69 years old. She went through.
When?
She's
when?
Going to be 69 years old next time around.
Well, she would be 68. She would be 68.
All right, fine. Let's not quibble. She has been through an incredibly.
Just call it an old 68, okay?
She's been through one incredibly grueling presidential campaign. She has served as Secretary of State. Yeah. You know, I think there's a real possibility that she'll decide to run, but I think we have to acknowledge that we really don't know, you know, and she has achieved quite a lot of her ambitions, perhaps more than she even expected. But getting back to the hearing,
yeah,
I mean, she was she did display her usual brilliance, her usual toughness. But I think it's also important to note that Hillary Clinton is a lot smarter and a lot tougher and a lot more experienced than Ron Johnson, the Wisconsin senator who you were just quoting, and Rand Paul, and some of the other Republicans who were attacking her.
Even John somewhat McCain.
Somewhat hysterically. And I think it was also the way they attacked her and the way they've been alleging that she didn't really have a concussion, she didn't really have the flu, she was trying to avoid these healings. It was just a reminder of the way Hillary Clinton just brings out such viciousness on the part not just of the wingnuts,
but the media,
you know,
too.
Focusing
a lot
on
of every
critics.
Single yeah, now she got very emotional
right.
and very angry.
Right.
She got annoyed once.
And
yeah.
it's a reminder.
In 5.5 hours.
It's a reminder that she was really our first lady, who was a highly accomplished, not just highly intelligent, but a highly accomplished, highly educated professional woman in her own right. She was much more untraditional than Eleanor Roosevelt, who was one of our most untraditional first ladies. Eleanor Roosevelt followed a fairly traditional path for an educated progressive woman of her day. And Hillary Clinton just still brings this
out.
Okay,
now that we've put her on Mount Rushmore, can I say
something? No, you know, I just want to add, I don't put her on Mount Rushmore. I've disagreed with her in a lot of things.
Peniel said iconic and heroic.
Well, Peniel said that.
I'm agreeing with
Peniel. Right, so let's come back to reality here for a minute. We got four dead Americans, a dead ambassador, and we're sitting here talking about how she performed. And this is what I don't understand about punditry. You know, you look at the presidential race, and it's all about how they performed in the debate. And it's not about the issue. It's not about the substance of what was said. And the fact is she performed well. I give her that.
And the substance was really good.
Well, I think the Republicans were inept in their questioning. I think they let her off the hook. And didn't get to the crux of the matter here.
She tried.
And the fact is she was Secretary of State when this breakdown occurred. And there were some valid questions that still haven't been answered.
But
somebody has to be accountable. We're sitting here calling her heroic with four dead Americans. That's the part of this equation I don't understand.
People have been held accountable. There was a thorough investigation by this, you know, independent group. Three or four State
Lost
Department people.
Yep.
I think they were suspended because as Secretary Clinton explained, you know, the rules prevented them from being fired. Accountability and responsibility for these terrible mistakes were leveled at the assistant secretary level. She said that she took responsibility. So I really don't think it's fair to say that there was no investigation, there was no accountability, because there has been. Well, and it's also, I think, important to remember that I think it was Petraeus who testified before the Senate committee, I don't know, some couple of months ago, who said on the matter of the talking points, the Susan Rice talking points, which were so controversial,
right,
that they had been approved by the CIA and that she was giving what had been the declassified CIA talking points.
Well, yeah. I mean, the whole idea of the talking points and Rice being objectified by and demonized by the Republican Party is absurd, because in February of 2003, Colin Powell gave talking points to the United Nations for a cause of war, to go to war against Iraq, that turned out to be false.
Provably
It turned
false.
Out to be demonstrably
false. Yeah, that doesn't
false.
Make what Rice did correct. They should both be held accountable.
No, no,
and I don't like it.
It just shows that we have,
I don't
we
like
have
when
intelligence breakdowns.
Lies to
we
the American
are, no, no, they weren't lying. We're
a Democrat.
We are a big country. We are a big country, and we have intelligence breakdowns. We had intelligence breakdowns about WMDs. We can either say George Bush knowingly lied and led thousands of Americans into slaughter, or it was an intelligence
failure.
And what we had then was an intelligence failure with much larger consequences, because we went to war as a nation. So the idea that Susan Rice or Hillary Clinton was trying to lie about Benghazi is absolutely absurd. And we have a demonstrably proven instance in terms of 2003 where we had another massive intelligence failure.
Well, and Susan Rice was held accountable. She wasn't even nominated for Secretary of State. That's serious
and
accountability
it wasn't her
for
fault.
Her.
I mean,
that's scapegoating.
It
that's
was
not,
the, it
that's
was the
not,
White House
that's
fault.
Not accountability. That's
that was another area where Hillary Clinton really explained well what happened. She said the White House decides who goes on the Sunday morning talk show.
Yeah.
I actually didn't know that. They decided who to put forward. They chose Susan Rice, probably because they wanted to make her look good as a potential Secretary of State candidate. They put her out there. They gave her the talking points. They redacted certain things. They rewrote certain things. She went along with it.
Absolutely.
Bingo.
Yeah.
Well, I think part of what made her look good was the Republicans' ineptness.
And there we agree.
Coordinated. I mean, you had repetitive questions. Right. There were some guys who
repetitive
did.
Repetitive speeches.
The kid from
not
Illinois did a
questions.
Great job. The Air Force guy from Illinois, I forget his name right now, but he was absolutely phenomenal. And if they at all had kind of taken the line of questioning that he took and used their time in a more efficient manner, it might have been a different outcome.
Well, I think, you know, Hillary Clinton is used to this sort of thing.
Sure.
She's very well prepared, and I think she would have performed well under any circumstances.
Hey, she's been testifying before Congress since what? Since the mid-70s.
Right.
Oh, that's true. Every gate imaginable.
Yeah.
All right. Also yesterday we heard the same confirmation hearings of Senator John Kerry, and it was actually Ron Johnson again, Senator Ron Johnson, who got one of the better quotes out of John Kerry. Here's that exchange.
Well, Senator, if you're trying to get some daylight between me and Secretary Clinton, that's not going to happen here today.
I've never heard that phrase before. I mean, I get it.
Yeah.
Meaning,
really?
You're not going to find any differences between the two of us.
Oh, it's a pretty common
phrase. Okay, well, I missed that one.
It's a NASCAR term.
Yeah, oh, okay.
From what I saw of the Kerry hearing, I thought his best moment was in the very beginning when the code pink woman came in and started shouting and she was escorted out.
Oh, yeah. He was great.
He was terrific. You know, he made this very respectful, measured statement saying, you know what, this is where people are supposed to come to have their voices heard. And when I first came to Washington, I came to protest a war.
Yeah,
and I thought that was just terrific.
I always wonder, because this happens virtually every time there's an important event, whether it's a debate or one of these hearings. How do these people get in? How do they get in? You know, of all the red flags and all the security.
They don't have mind screeners yet.
Right, exactly. But they will.
They went through metal detectors anyway, so.
Your nutty radar doesn't go off? Mine would.
Well, they're working
here comes
on that. Wendy can enlighten us a little more about that.
Yeah,
let's
hope
on
that they never get nutty radar. Then we'd all be in trouble.
Thought police.
Right. All right, well.
I hope John Kerry, by the way, performs as Secretary of State similar to the way he did yesterday and when he went to Washington after Vietnam and asked those kinds of questions, because we're in a period of time where those questions need to be asked now and they're not being asked with these endless wars that we're engaged in.
Well, you know what? This is John Kerry's last job, I assume, last political job. And that can free you up.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. All right, we're talking with social critic and attorney Wendy Kaminer, Peniel Joseph, professor of history at Tufts University, and Weymouth State Senator Bob Hedlund coming up. Thumbs up, thumbs down. I'm Emily Rooney, and you're listening to Boston Public Radio. This is Boston Public Radio. I'm Emily Rooney. It is time for ever popular thumbs up, thumbs down on the people, places, and issues in the news. This week, we're joined by Tufts University professor of history, Peniel Joseph, Weymouth State Senator Bob Hedlund, an attorney and social critic. Wendy Kaminer. All right, first up, our inaugural segment. Thumbs up, thumbs down on Justice Antonin Scalia's hat.
I give Justice Scalia so many thumbs down on so many important issues that I'm going to give him a thumbs up on his hat just in the sake of proverbial balance.
Does everybody remember the hat?
I'll give him a thumbs up, but I didn't care one way or the other, to be honest with you.
It was cold. You had to give him a thumbs up. It was a fashion statement.
Yeah, it was a fashion statement.
There was a lot of good fashion, let's face it. How about thumbs up, thumbs down on Michelle Obama's fashion? Holy smoke. She's $1 million. More than a million. $1 million isn't that much anymore. We got to change that phrase. She looks like $1 million.
Well, you know, Michelle Obama is a beautiful woman, and yeah. She can look like $1 million dressed in any number
J.Crew.
Of ways.
Yeah.
Right,
yeah.
Dressed in J.Crew.
Or Jason Wu.
I will reserve my other comments about fashion for another time.
Okay, good. All right, thumbs up, thumbs down. This is all critical. Everybody's been talking about this, and I got my insight last night, by the way, on Inside Edition, so I have something to add to this. But thumbs up, thumbs down on Beyonce lip-syncing, Peniel.
Well, I'd say thumbs down on the coverage of it, you know, because at CNN, I was watching CNN, and they gave it so much time.
I know, like days
that
and
it
days.
It was ridiculous. So this is not a national story. She taped the recording the night before, and she, cold weather, lip-sync. It's not a big deal. Yo-Yo Ma did the same thing, remember, 4 years ago. Yo-Yo Ma.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with Peniel. I give thumbs down on caring about this and covering it to the extent that the media has covered it.
I don't remember Yo-Yo Ma doing it, but I do remember
Milli Vanilli.
But, you know, I'd rather have a little more genuineness involved in a ceremony like that. So I give it a thumbs down, and I give it a thumbs down on the coverage. But at least the coverage didn't rival the coverage of Michelle Obama's dress on CNN. Yeah.
So according to, you know, Inside Edition, and they have these double mics, you could turn off the other sound and just listen to her singing. She did sing. She sang the whole thing. But what you could hear was the lip sync version. So her voice was there. She was singing into a microphone along with herself. So technically,
that makes sense.
She sang it.
Yeah.
I give her a thumbs up anyway. How can I give Beyonce a thumbs down for anything?
Yeah.
Thumbs up, thumbs down on Michelle Obama's icy stare at Speaker Boehner.
You know, I give a thumbs down on policing everybody 24/7 so that we capture every smile, every grimace, every elbow on every table. You know, none of us can be perfect all the time, knowing that we are on all the time. And please, let's just let it go.
Was it the icy stare or the eye roll?
Eye roll.
You know, there's been some back and forth on this.
I thought she was eye-rolling at Obama,
Yes, that's what some people are now saying, that it wasn't necessary. She was kind of, in a sense, agreeing with
what
Boehner
thought.
Said. So who knows? I mean, but Wendy's right. I mean, to try to analyze that, we're going down a crazy road, I think.
That is not going to go away. All right, moving on to our arts, entertainment, eat, drink, and be merry segment. Thumbs up, thumbs down on Robert De Niro developing a new drama for Showtime called The Fourth Reich. And it's featuring neo-Nazis who live, guess where, South Boston, described as the town needs American History X. Peniel, what do you make of that?
I don't know. I mean, in a way, it's sort of stereotyping South Boston's past. So I don't know if there are – it'd be interesting to know.
Neo-Nazis?
Are there neo-Nazis in South Boston? You know, it sounds absurd on the face of it. So I'd be interested to know, what are they basing this on?
I think there are neo-Nazis in parts of the U.S., and I think for the most part that South Boston is probably not the hotbed of neo-Nazis right now. So I wouldn't – you know, I think it would be interesting and perhaps useful to see a good drama about neo-Nazis in the U.S., but not set in South Boston for the sake of sensationalism.
I've lived here my whole life. I know South Boston well. I know a lot of people from South Boston. I remember when the KKK in the 70s tried to organize a march, or some white supremacist group, and they were told to get lost. I mean, so I think it's preposterous. A big thumbs down.
Half of them wouldn't even know what a neo-Nazi is. I'm thinking, giving this a thumbs down. I think it's going to be a bust, too, as most of these things are. All right, moving on to our eating, drinking category. Thumbs up, thumbs down on a buzzing fork that helps you lose weight. All right, it's called the Happy Fork, Wendy. It buzzes when you've eaten just the right amount. Thumbs up, thumbs down.
Thumbs down. Can I give a little thumbs up to self-control and a?
Well, look at you. You're so fit, and you know.
You know, and look, everybody's got their own natural weight. Go find it. Stop relying on gimmicks and buzzing forks. And you know what? If all you're eating is garbage, a buzzing fork is not going to help you that much anyway.
Thumbs up. for entrepreneurs and the free market.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I say thumbs up to the extent that if people need this to help them as part of their weight loss goals, that's going to be fine.
Well, I don't know why they call it happy fork. They call it loser fork or something like that. All right. Thumbs up, thumbs down on two New Jersey men who are suing Subway because the footlong sub, as it turns out, is really only 11 inches.
I think that we should consign them to having to use the happy fork. I mean, you know, this is just like self-parody of an overly litigious society. Right. It's completely absurd.
At least this one has some legitimacy.
Oh, really?
Well,
really,
I don't know.
Emily?
You know, I don't know if it's overly litigious in this sense. I remember years ago when the woman sued McDonald's for the cup of coffee being too hot. And it turned out that McDonald's coffee was scalding hot. It was way, way too hot. And she had gotten third-degree burn. So it seemed silly at the time. I think these two are just all about, are you going to have truth in advertising?
Yeah, but you know what? An 11-inch sub as opposed to a 12-inch sub is not going to hurt you the way a 200-cup coffee
they're right. It's truth in advertising, though. It's like a pound of coffee is not a pound
of
coffee
anymore. I got to go thumbs down. But I want to sue my coffee shop I went in this morning because my coffee wasn't hot enough.
Yeah.
I'm going to find that lawyer.
All right, thumbs up, thumbs down on Bostonians only losing 74,500 pounds in Mayor Menino's 1 million pound challenge.
Well, we need the happy fork. We need Boston needs the happy fork. So
first of all, love you, Mayor, but you blew this. Nobody took charge of this program. I mean, nobody. I mean, he announced it and then it went away. Absolutely nobody. This could have been a fun thing. We could have challenged other cities. It just disappeared. It could have been a corporate thing. Who's in charge of this? Nobody.
Well, the mayor's been ill though.
No. So. He could have designated, put somebody in charge of this.
The mayor should focus on being the urban mechanic, sweeping the streets, improving the schools, and not worry about playing the role of Jenny Craig.
Yeah, well, this could have been fun. This could have worked.
I don't know. What has been the experience of other cities? Didn't Philadelphia have a similar program?
Yeah,
How did they do?
I think they did pretty good. No, I think this is all about health, and I think that we're an overweight country. That, you know, somebody who wants lower taxes, Bob, you know, the more fit we are, the lower our health care costs.
Let me give Menino
it's
a
not
plug.
Too late.
Let me give him a plug on one thing that he has done that I think's improved the city of Boston and health, and I get beat up on this, but the improvement of bicycle access in the city of Boston has been remarkable.
Let me give him a big thumbs down on that. I mean,
I
knew you were going to say that.
The liberal is...
I can't tell you the number of times I have seen cyclists weaving through traffic in the middle of lanes, driving the wrong way down one-way streets, engaging in really dangerous behavior. And I can't stand the sanctimoniousness of these bikers. I just can't stand it. So I give him a thumbs down.
The roads are archaic, and he didn't have much to work with given the Boston street
grid. I'm one of the bikers who follows the rules, though, so I do like more access.
I'm somewhere in between.
Thumbs up on bikers. All right. Did y'all read that piece in the Globe today about Shaw's Market? So thumbs up, thumbs down on shoppers naming Shaw's one of the worst grocery chains in the country.
Oh, my goodness. Let me tell you.
There's a Shaw's right next to me in
Porter. There's a Shaw's next to me.
I like Shaw's. They've been good.
I feel bad for the folks that work there because it is woefully understaffed. I can never find a human being to work the registers. I'm old school. I don't like the self-checkout stuff. The one next to me is problematic, and I oftentimes go there based on convenience, but I often drive right past it, and I go 2 miles out of my way.
You're apparently not alone.
Is it? Where's that?
Is
that a new one over in Brookline near, is that a Shaw's?
I don't generally shop at Shaw's, so I can't comment on it one way or another.
I shop at Shaw's, and the Shaw's in Porter Square is fine.
Really? Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know how, and by the way, it's also described as one of the most expensive. It can't top
Whole paycheck.
Whole paycheck. All right. Well, where are we going here? I don't know. Let's see. Should we do a couple of sports ones and then we'll have Jared Bowen come in and take right over? All right. Thumbs up, thumbs down. Are you still going to be wearing your Lance Armstrong Livestrong bracelets now that poor Lance has admitted to cheating?
Well, even though I'm the cyclist, Pinnell and I are the cyclists here, I never wore one to begin with, so.
I think Lance Armstrong is a thoroughly despicable character, not because he doped. I really couldn't care less whether or not athletes are using various performance-enhancing substances. But what is really despicable about Lance Armstrong is what many of people talked about, the not just the lying, but the bullying of other people who are telling the truth.
And women and everybody else.
Right,
but
the attempt to destroy people who are telling the truth about him. I think he is a thoroughly despicable character.
But we should
character.
Separate Lance from the cause. So, I mean, I never had a strong one either, but... you know, I think
it was a good cause.
It's a great
cause. It's a great
cause.
It's a great cause that greatly benefited Lance Armstrong financially.
Emily, thumbs up to the library in Australia that moved his books to the fiction department.
Yeah. Oh. All right, two more quickly. Thumbs up, thumbs down. Is this the end of the Brady Belichick era? Thumbs down. No, it's not the end.
I think it's the beginning of the end, given Brady's age.
Well, I think they still have a couple of more years left.
I think Belichick retires the day Brady leaves.
And finally, thumbs up, thumbs down on the Red Sox naming former pitcher Pedro Martinez as special assistant to general manager Ben Sherrington. Martinez, of course, was a key part of the Red Sox 2004 championship team.
It's probably part of that marketing effort for Nesson that Francona talks
he's
about
like,
in his
he's
book.
Like
we
Shaq
need a little
O'Neal.
More sizzle,
Shaq
and we're not
O'Neal.
We're not doing well, it without
like
free agent signing. So let's
Reggie's
right.
always a special assistant, so that's what
Perfect.
That is. Yeah.
Yeah, but they told Reggie to shut up, though. They put a muzzle on him.
I don't know
Reggie
if Pedro's going to shut up. The question is, will he show up? He's apparently notoriously
does he need
unreliable.
To show up?
Really, does he need to show up? Exactly.
All right. My thanks today to Tufts University Professor of History, Peniel Joseph, Weymouth State Senator Bob Hedlund, and attorney and social critic Wendy Kaminer. Thanks for that roundup of the week's news. And Jared Bowen is here.
Hi, Emily. We're going to go cabaret in a second. We have a couple of performances from Stephen Sondheim's Marry Me a Little. And I should point out that...
Wait, is that what this music stuff is on here? They're actually going to be singing right here in the studio.
They're going to be singing right here in the studio. And he got... Remember when he got involved with Porgy and Bess?
Oh, yeah.
And wanted to have a say in that? Well, he's gotten involved here as well, but it has a much different outcome. So we'll talk about that.
Yeah, so Stephen Sondheim wasn't as cranky about this. Okay. All right. I'm Emily Rooney, and this is Boston Public Radio.